Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to another episode of In the Eyes of Truth. Back with us is Robert Barnes, 1776 Law Center. And I love that Bourbon Barnes sign in the back. If you're wondering, I am on vacation. This is why the setup looks like that, the way it is, and that there's a fewer shows than normal. Rob, welcome back. And right before we started this, we were talking about Vegas because Robert has just moved in to Tennessee. Welcome back to the South from Vegas. So how is Vegas these days?
I first went through Vegas in 2004, so a little more than 20 years ago.
Hello, dear friends. Just want to remind you, if you like this video or you like what you hear, click like, subscribe if you haven't subscribed yet. Send it to your friends. Let's grow this channel. Maybe we can finally hit it up to 100,000. That'd be a good round number for the summer. So let me know, leave some comments, and give a thumbs up. So look forward to seeing you in the next video. Cheers.
On my way out to Malibu, where I was moving from Wisconsin at the time, I grew up in Tennessee. The and it was it was you know I drove in on July 4th, so you had the fireworks all over the place. You had a mixture of old school hotels and new school hotels. The billionaire influence was flooding in. Some of the Arab money and real estate booming money was flooding in. You had all these different projects, a new Fountain Blue they were trying to build, a new, the Cosmopolitan set of, an Aria set of hotels they were trying to build. So you had this cross mixture of old mob influence type hotels that had individual small owners, your sort of mega millionaires. You had your billionaires, your Adelsons, your Wynns, your Kevorkians. And then you had this new Arab golf money that was going to be in the Fountain Blue and the Cosmopolitan and the Aria and the new Four Seasons. And they were redoing the Flamingo, they're redoing the Tropicana. They were redoing they were going to tear down the Sahara and put in a new fancy SWS hotel. So it was starting its sort of resurrection. Then 08 hit. 08 took a massive hit. They didn't finish the Fontainebleau for like 15 years. Trump was trying to build his casino at the end. Steve Wynn was blocking it. So all ever went up was his hotel because Trump had blocked Wynn in New Jersey 15 years before,
That was
and when was the
personal.
yeah oh yeah old school personal for vendettas. Then the Cosmopolitan had to sell off a lot of its equity interest because they got overextended in the global financial crisis with some of the Emirati money and Saudi royal money. But they were able to sort of get through that to 2012, 2014. I bought at the bottom of its real estate market because Vegas had been one of those places that had got way out of over its skis in the real estate market. So I was able to buy a place for dirt cheap that, to give you an idea, 10 years later would triple in value. The union still had their strength. Harry Reid was able to survive the 2010 Senate onslaught by just like 1/10 of a percentage point. Everybody thought it was DOA, but the old man still had some life left in the old union machine that was still operative. And so I was there all the way through until I moved there. I would go there during the fall to bet on football because the only place you could legally bet on sports in the United States for
Is it
elections, I
really?
had to fly all the way over to the UK. But at that point, the only place you could bet with bookies and illegally and throughout. Now, it wasn't illegal for you to place the bet. It was illegal for them to accept it in all of these jurisdictions. The problem is you couldn't enforce it contractually. So so if you had any degree of success, either bookies wouldn't take your action or would stiff you, they're on that side of the aisle. So I needed to go there to place bets in the football season. So I'd go there, spend time. I wanted to explore the city, Malibu and California. Malibu was beautiful. Lived there for a decade, but the problem was California was getting nuts. The politics was getting way out of hand. I realized this was not a safe place for someone of dissident representing dissidents in the legal space to
Right.
be. And so I was like, I'm moving to Vegas. I like Vegas. I like the food. I like the, it's a blue collar city, but it's a resort town with resort town amenities. So it was like, to me, the best combination, and saw it sort of progress until like 2020 came around. And the fractures in the foundation, so Kevorkian had died off and MGM had become purely corporatized. The old Las Vegas Hilton had effectively become the Westgate, and it had started to become corporatized. It was one of the great sports books of all, you know, all time. It was starting not to have quite the same resonance. And then, you know, in 2020, something I saw happen that I thought never would happen. You had Oscar Goodman, the famous mobster, his wife, mobster's lawyer. His wife was mayor of Vegas. And yet they ultimately capitulated to shutting down Vegas, became like a zombie-esque town. It felt like you're walking through a zombie movie. When they did even partially open it up, it was like gangsters that would flood the place because everything was suddenly cheap. And, you know, you had people shooting off guns in the wind and stuff like that. So I was like, this is not sustainable. And around that time, a few, you know, flash forward a few years later, Sheldon Adelson is dead. Miriam Adelson moves all the assets to China. She doesn't own anything anymore in the U.S. other than some sports teams in Dallas.
Really?
But nothing on the Strip. Yeah, really? Miriam Adelson's everything is in Macau. The Venetian in Macau was already making double, triple profit margins what the one in Vegas was. But essentially the whole – and then Steve Wynn had issues with his ex-wife. His ex-wife sat on the board, used the Me Too movement, and people didn't like Trump because Wynn had started to raise money for Trump to knife him in the back and push him out of Wynn and Encore. So these guys that – these billionaires, these multimillion – the multimillionaire families all sold out to corporations or private equity, including the people that own the Palms, that own the Boulder, that own the Station Hotels, all of those. So by 2024 – 2025, that whole town now is corporate. There isn't millionaire individual owners. There aren't vestigial mob connected kind of places. There aren't billionaire owners. It's just a bunch of Wall Street corporations and private equity. And these people have lost the personal touch. So all of a sudden, if you're a local, you have to pay $5-$10 to park your car. You have to valet it. You don't get any special discounts on the buffet. They started getting rid of the buffets because they didn't like the margins on the buffets. They got rid of their personal concierges, and there were like different classes of concierges. You had your high-end ones who were there for your high-end guests, your mid-level ones there for your mid-level guests, and your lower ones, but who are still knew the personal touch to so that the locals and other people knew, hey, I go there, George is going to give me a $5 discount on this, or maybe 2-for-1 cocktail, something a little bit that made you feel connected and that brought in the business that stabilized their gaming revenue. All of that is gone. They're scrapping those people left and right. They're corporatizing and industrializing everything. They charge you $18 for bottled water in your room. They're trying to keep you captive. They don't want you to go to other casinos or other sport or other venues on the Strip, even ones that are co-owned by people like MGM. They've consolidated the power. They've standardized their sports books. They drive out. If you're a good sports bettor, they drive you out more often than not. There's only one or two sports books you can consistently get action on. And they've lowered and dumbed down the entertainment. There's fewer long-term gigs. You know, say, hey, so-and-so's coming in here for 6 months. You know, if there was a while, if you wanted to see Mariah Carey, you could only go to Vegas to see Mariah Carey.
Right.
They're getting rid of a lot of those long-term 5-year, 10-year deals. Because it's so corporatized, it's classic private equity thinking and corporate thinking, and so they're really struggling. Now Trump added to that because a lot of Europeans and others were skeptical of coming to the U.S. You know, they were spreading rumors if you came to the U.S., Trump would deport you, did it down to El Salvador, and stick you in, you know, that kind of thing. There are people who are afraid to come to the World Cup for a period of time for that reason. So you had that kind of, you know, and Canadians didn't want to visit, that kind of thing. Then you had sort of U.S. political hostility with these wars, not only the Russia-Ukraine war, but also the Iran war, and then all of a sudden deposing people in Venezuela. That kind of discouraged. There were a good number of illegals that were flowing through Vegas, both in the underground economy and in terms of because a lot of them loved to gamble. So at the lower end gambling casinos, all of a sudden they're mostly gone. So you aggregate that, and then you antagonize the locals, and you antagonize the people that would come a couple of times a year. And all of a sudden, your margins start to really shrink. And their answer to that is to double the cost of everything and just double down on a high-end customer. A high-end customer that are no longer providing personalized services.
Right. Wait. High-end customer that can go fly anywhere in the world anytime he wants to.
Exactly. Like, you know, you see it in Casino and those old-school movies. They always knew You know, give him all the free rooms he wants. Give him all the prostitutes he wants. Give him all the food, you know, the high end shows he wants. Give him the personal treatment. Make him think great, because he's going to lose all that money at times two at the blackjack table or the baccarat table or the slots or the one of those. But those are the people they're eliminating by, oh, why are we spending extra money on this? Why are we giving extra bonuses over here? Why are we doing this? They're destroying it.
You know, I used to go to Singapore. I won't say a lot, but I've been there a half dozen times because of the offices we had when I was a director in Halliburton. And, you know, they told me that, I've been to the casinos in Singapore, and they said they love the Chinese because the Chinese will go in there, the Chinese millionaires and billionaires, they'll drop $3-5 million in a night, gone, no problem. I'll come back next month and drop $3-5 million. They don't count their losses. So right. If you're driving away those kinds of guys,
I mean, that's how bad it was. So like Wynn had started to shift his whole Vegas project to something like the one he had in Macau, which was already making 2x what he wanted, to the Chinese customer that didn't want to go to Macau, right. The one that wanted to get the extra side benefits of Vegas, the ego boost, the personal boost, all the rest. And they've mostly walked that back because they don't understand the broader, bigger picture. They don't understand that it's all there to make them feel great while they lose lots of money. All they want them to do is lose lots of money.
Feelings are optional.
Exactly. And they don't understand what the gig was, what it was all about. So a lot of my friends that are old school Vegas people that have been there since the 80s are saying it's the worst it's ever been. And so that's why it's struggling. That's why. And then, of course, in the U.S. now, they've legalized sports gambling. Across the country. So Vegas no longer has a monopoly on that. Increasingly, the that shrinks what edge it offers. And if you take away the specialized shows, if you take away that unique experience, what happens in Vegas stays in Vegas. I mean, they even started to obsessively crack down on the prostitutes. It's like that's half of Vegas for these high-end money spenders and bachelor legal. Party guys.
The prostitution is legal in Nevada.
In certain, there's, you know, there's the famous ranches and all of
right,
that.
Right.
But essentially they decided they didn't want that because they're industrialized, corporatized imagery. So they want a whole different image, and they want to make it just sort of a pay for service. They segregate the services in ways that they don't understand the holistic experience. It's about giving this person this emotional, psychological high that they're willing to pay double or triple for it at the slot machine, at the craps table. And they don't understand that. And consequently, I mean, they don't understand that running off your smart, sharp gamblers is a bad idea because the good bookies use that information to take money from all the saps. Now you don't know what the good information is, and you might get had because you're on the wrong side of a line because you blocked that sharp better from making what would have been just 2-3% of your total handle on a given bet anyway. And so it's just basic misunderstanding. I mean, my old buddy John Murray, legendary Westgate sportsbook manager, might get pushed out for the first time in like 20 years because a corporation has come in and bought up the whole casino and the whole hotel. And it's sad to see, really, because, you know, I got to see something that it would have been like being in Havana in 1957. And you see something that's totally, you know, like the portrayed in The Godfather Part Two. You know, I got to see that part of Vegas for the better part of 20 years. And I know it's not coming back. It's going to be gone. And it's going to be someplace overseas somewhere that recreates it, because it's not happening here in Vegas.
You know, in government, you have technocrats. But I mean, private equity, it's technocrats in business. Is there anything that private equity has touched that it hasn't turned to crap?
It's like Barbarians at the Gate, you know, the book and the movie from the mid 1980s. And it's that, I mean, like I have a case here in Tennessee, and it's a couple that had been very successful in separate independent businesses, came up with the idea of creating scaling up a specialized boutique tour bus services that would be a one-stop shop. They would build the buses. They would serve the buses. They would manage the buses. They would operate the buses. They would market the buses for all these country musicians and others who like to have a reliable boutique set of services to
Right.
them. Okay, if I got this one, I know who my driver is. I know
Yep.
who the cleaners are. I know who the repair guy is. I know who the owner is. I got it all. I know they built it from scratch. So, I don't got to worry about that. Last thing I want to worry about if I'm a tour manager. And they get private equity to fund it to so that they can scale up, because banks don't know how to evaluate that kind of business. And banks have increasingly stayed away from this, giving money to private equity behind the scenes because that would limit their liability exposure as well.
Mm-hmm.
These private equity guys come in, encourage them to build up the fleet and say, don't worry about paying back the loan right away, because we need to maximize the value of this fleet as quickly as possible so we can scale up before anybody else does. So they do that. And then what do? When they finish scaling up the whole enterprise, having it ready to turnkey and roll, they come in and foreclose on them. They say, oh, you know what? The loan payments haven't been made. Oh, what? You mean the ones you told us not to make? Yeah, those. And we're going to steal the whole business from you and sell it off to these different participants for parts. And what they did in the process was actually destroy their own equity, destroy their own collateral, so that they're not even going to be able to get repaid. So it was like, it wasn't even economically savvy or wise. It was short-sighted and nearsighted. It was like the worst version of the Russian oligarchs in the 90s, right?
Yep,
you had some sharp ones who knew how to expand and extend. And then you had a bunch of dumb ones who just went in and tried to sell everything off for parts.
Yep.
And we're actually self-destructive in the end. That's what American private equity's done. They've done it to the fast food industry. They've done it to the food chain industry. They're doing it. Doing it to all these different, that helped do it to Vegas. They built the Fontainebleau, and they, billed people $25 for, a piece of toast, and they thought that was going to work. I mean, it's people who only know how to look at a spreadsheet. It's technocrats who have no real life experience.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's destroying American industry and enterprise, and is creating a huge credit bubble right underneath what is already a bigger credit bubble in the AI space. So it's about to blow up on everybody, and most of Washington and Wall Street is asleep at the wheel while ordinary Americans are experiencing it every day. I'll give you another example. Private equity bought up almost all the veterinarians in the United States. Majority of vet shops are now private equity owned. So what do they start doing? They start lobbying legislatures and executive government bodies, particularly all these administrative bureaucrats who want to cash out when they leave from their government gig and have their 20-year pension. They want to tag another nice little bonus on top of it. These people come and lobby them. Hey, crack down on small farmers. So Tucker Carlson was covering the private equity from a totally different side of the equation in the vet business. I was experiencing it in the Amish world, because all of a sudden they're harassing Amish farmers. You need to have a vet on staff permanently, or we're going to come and shut you down for how this animal's handled, or this issue's handled, or that issue's handled. Of course, many of them can't scale up. So what they're really trying to do is to force them to sell off to big corporate agriculture, who can come and buy up their land, reduce the quality of the food to get an extra margin edge, and using the vet controls to do it. And private equity wins on both sides. They win because they own a share of the vet operations, and they win because they own a share of the ag operations. But all the rest of us suffer in the process. The animals end up worse treated, not better treated. The quality of the food coming out is worse rather than better. We've seen that in all the cattle that's been destroyed over the last 10 years because of this concentration of cattle at the top, making them more vulnerable to food supply problems. Like we had just, I don't know if this happens a whole lot in Russia, but we have a parasitic outbreak all the time here. Like and it'll be because our food supply is so monopolized. So, Taco Bell gets almost a whole lot of its lettuce from one single supplier in a foreign country, in Mexico, no less. So a parasite shows up. What happens? Everybody gets real explosive diarrhea, not just your regular diarrhea from Taco Bell. And you all of a sudden have a parasitic outbreak that affects half the country. And this happens repeatedly, and the regulators do nothing about it because they're too busy harassing Amish farmers in Pennsylvania.
Yeah, I remember that there was always almost every year there was some kind of outbreak in the U.S. You don't see that in Russia. There's some local outbreaks, obviously they happen, but no, I don't remember ever having an outbreak. It came back in 2010, and I don't think there's ever been a massive outbreak like the ones that we had in the U.S. when I was living there. It was every year. In fact, 2009 was a massive outbreak. A bunch of people died from hepatitis. I guess the You can't get the illegals to wash their hands after they take a shite, and they just
Right.
kept picking the lettuce, and it went through. People were screaming tomatoes, and everybody's getting rid of tomatoes. Then, oh no, it must be cucumbers, and it turned out to be the lettuce.
Exactly. And it's a combination of the labor sources, but particularly since it's like during COVID, there should have been a massive red flag that went up everywhere where we suddenly had a beef shortage. And it's like, how does the United States of America have a beef shortage? But it's because 85% of our beef supply is controlled by three or four corporations. Same with our pork supply now. Same with our chicken supply now. And they treat them the worst. We have industrialized, like, I mean, the chickens, they literally live off their own shit, basically, and our corporate chickens. I mean, they stick them in these tiny little cages. It's horrendous kind of physical conditions to be in. My brother has chickens, and whenever he puts them in their big, generous coop, they're still yipping away because they want out. Thomas Massie famously created a specialized coop that gave them maximized freedom that they could move around in. It was one of the places one of his patents he made a lot of money on. But that kind of indigenous farming and organic supply, they're trying to, like, right now, Americans on average only get 2% of their food directly from a farmer. It's the lowest level by far in American history. A century ago, that was 60, 70%. To give people a comparison, the before that it was 95%, and so that's at the time of our founding, and they're still even trying to wipe that 2% out. Like, I'm gonna have to go to a hearing soon. Amos Miller, the Amish farmer, they're trying to get a contempt order and sanctions order, try to shut him down again, and may try to literally physically imprison him until he discloses every person he's ever worked with or provided food to, because they want to shut it down to everybody everywhere. And this is a guy that's, given millions of food products to tens of thousands of Americans with literally zero customer complaints in over a quarter century, the best safety record in the country. That's the guy they're trying to
Damn.
shut down. While Taco Bell, they're not even giving warnings to people in Pennsylvania about the problems that the lettuce has and all of the food that's causing this explosive parasitic problem across the country.
Ever since Clinton, and most people don't realize this, Clinton removed the Glass-Steagall Act, and it's been shit show ever since. No pun intended
Yes.
with the lettuce. But
That
I
was
mean.
when Wall Street really got into full blown power. And since the Clinton era moves is when the wealth gap has skyrocketed, is when the income gap has skyrocketed. Like, we have the most out of, well, we're at the level of the French Revolution, probably leading up to, I mean, that's the level. You have like one, you have about 1,000 American families that have more wealth than the bottom 50%, the bottom 150, 200 million Americans combined. And that is a recipe for disaster wherever it has happened, anytime in world history. And so that's why they're cheering for the Mamdanis in New York. That's why democratic socialists are on the rise. It's because of the failure of the institutional parties to deliver meaningful economically shared prosperity for the American people, which is what we had a great run both between from Andrew Jackson 1828 to 1860. If you were an independent yeoman, farmer, or tradesman, you had your biggest gain of wealth at any time up to that point. And then between 1940 and 1970, you had one of the biggest explosions of middle class wealth anywhere in the world in the United States. Since then, it's been going down, but it has been on an acceleration since the 1990s. And we have a badly K-shaped economy that is completely out of whack, that the global financial crisis made worse, that then the pandemic lockdowns made even worse. We still haven't recovered. Trump doesn't even understand it. Trump doesn't understand he was put in there to reverse what was happening post-COVID, what was happening post-global financial crisis, what was happening post-Clinton. That was part of the whole trade policy pitch, was to reverse what Clinton's put into motion. And he's mostly abandoned all of it to serve sort of a deep state, donor-driven agenda that has him as a where he's, I mean, he literally told people that the regime change people, he was comparing himself to Genghis Khan and Attila the Hun. It's like, this is not a good comparison. I mean, this is bad. But it's where he's at mentally.
Oh yeah, you're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. Somebody was pointing out to me, oh yeah, and this is bad. I agree, this is bad. Russia The lower 50% of the population owns 15 or 16% of equity in the country, which is low. And I agree, it should be higher. But then I'm like, what's the US? It's 3%. So it's like, this is an American guy. It's like, while you're looking at it, why don't you look at your own, what's going on in the US? It's five times worse.
If
And
you see,
15%
like,
is low. I mean, 16%, 15, 16.
yeah, well, if you look at Russia, the I mean, with a lot, like, I remember with the very beginning of the Russian-Ukrainian conflict, Richard Barris and I went through a deep dive on economic and polling data as to why Russia was not going to collapse, why the Western caricatures of Russia were just caricatures, and we're just pointing out the massive improvement that had happened in Russia
Oh,
under
yeah.
Putin after once he got in. Drastic reduction in crime rate, drastic reduction in poverty rate, drastic reduction in a whole bunch of psychological indicators, dramatic improvement in life expectancy,
Yep,
which had
yep.
incredibly been going down in the 1990s. The level of self-reported satisfaction and pride in the country had skyrocketed. Return of more conservative cultural values aligned with the Russian Orthodox Church compared to what was happening in the 90s in Russia. That, it was just such, it was the most dramatic improvement in the shortest period of time in the last century anywhere in the world. It was like, there's no, this is why Putin is popular. It's not some oligarchic control. It's not, he may be wise and savvy about how he handles all of that, but it's like, that's where his power comes from. He's
Oh,
far
absolutely.
less, Russians have more functioning of a democracy than America does, is the reality of it.
And speaking of deep state, old Lindsey's now gone, and from what I understand, there's panic in the halls of Congress, at least for the neocon neoliberal wing. I know you've got great connections. Want to take that apart? Where
Yeah,
everything
the
stands right
lady
now?
Lindsay. What was fascinating is they were trying to spread rumors here that died off quickly that the Russians had poisoned them.
Oh yeah,
That
I saw.
You knew that they would float that out there as to try to get a rallying cry behind his insane sanctions bill that he was trying to push through the Senate, which includes up to 500% sanctions and of sanctioning all foreign bodies. Basically, it's a trade embargo on Russia in any way, shape, or form, which would be a disaster for us, mostly.
I
The everything about it was insane. But then there were other rumors that I said he might have died from Operation Midnight Hammer, because of the kind of people he liked to have fun with there in Kiev. So it wouldn't show, because Larry Johnson pointed out the schedule didn't make sense. I was
yeah,
like,
talk to
knowing
Larry.
Graham, there are a lot of rumors that he liked some of the same people that Keir Starmer got caught with in the UK, that they managed to suppress that whole story. Those young models, those young male models, that was like, well, hold on a second, something else is here. And Starmer just left before it could really blow up. Graham was infamous for that. He had accounts on Grindr, the dating gay app here in the United
Did he have
States.
accounts on Grindr? Seriously?
Yes, he did. He did. He actually had accounts on Grindr. And I don't know if you saw that. That young boy he was with at Kiev when he came this last trip, doesn't like you look at that, you're like, something's off here.
I mean, we all knew
It
that
would be
light in the
like Graham.
loafers, Lindsay, or Lady
Exactly.
Lindsay, you
It would be just like Graham. Can you imagine? He's in one of these little Kiev male brothels that they have underground all over the place, and he has a heart attack. What do you do? If you're in the US, you're like, oh, okay, this is not good.
Something up the arse
Yeah,
somewhere.
Lindsay getting the Operation Midnight Hammer has the heart attack. I mean, you can imagine the panic calls that from the CIA to Ukraine. They're like, oh my, what do we do with this? Oh, okay, just get him on the military plane. We got a special military plane there. Get him on that. Keep it all quiet. Keep it all secret. Bring him back to DC. We'll announce he's dead once he gets here. After he'll say, oh, he just had a heart attack sitting reading the Bible at home.
Lindsay.
Dreaming of the days that Russia will be conquered. Because everything, because they sent the FBI over to the house to clean up all the special little toys he had there and all the other stuff. They didn't want to show up at the estate sale, so they're busy getting rid of that as fast as they can.
Free the little
I
boys
suspect so.
still strapped somewhere in the basement,
Exactly.
chained to the walls.
Evidence of like crimes on top of crimes aside from his war crime history. Because I told people I had no love lost when he died. I was like, this is a man who had more blood on his hands than any American senator in American history. So the devil brought him home to where he belonged. And I was like, I know it's politically correct to say all these nice things. And it's like, no, the man was evil. The man was distillation of evil. And he visited evil upon the world. He joined John McCain down below where he long belonged. And so I think for the deep state, they are nervous because Graham had developed a worm tongue ability with Trump to whisper the most insane things into his brain and convince him of the most absurd ideas. And so someone that Trump and Trump's constituency long despised had become, had a hold on Trump. That was like the worm tongue character of the King in the Lord of the Rings. So without him there, they're going to have a harder time keeping Trump on a directed leash. So I'm going to be curious who they get to replace him. Because there's nobody that's easily there. He hates Dick Blumenthal, so that's not.
And Blumenthal has a personality of a limp, dead worm.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, Trump likes to call him. It was it Denning, whatever that fake place was that he pretended to have fought for, and got, it's totally fake. So he has no respect for him. There's nobody else on the Republican side that really, like Ted Cruz, is not someone Trump really listens to. Rubio only so from within the administration.
Right.
He's got Vance whispering the opposite, get out, for the love of God, get out. I think the deep state's going to be nervous about who do they replace Graham with? And apparently they're going to try to replace Graham in the Senate with his sister.
The governor already
to illegally funnel federal benefits to. It's like people are saying this was a noble thing. It's like, that's not noble. I adopted my sister as my daughter, pretended she was my daughter, so I could scam the federal government one last time. I think there'll be problems for her in the Senate seat because Nancy Mace is thinking about running, Ralph Norman thinking about running, Paul Dan's thinking about running. She may lose that nomination to the embarrassment of Trump or lose the general election because, the Graham himself was at risk of losing the general election in South Carolina. So it will be a major blow to the deep state that they don't have the Mr. Wormtongue, the king of the queen of the war horse, Lady Lindsay in the Senate to whisper crazy nonsense into Trump's ear. Won't stop Trump from still being crazy, but it will make it less easy to control and cabin where that craziness goes.
Well, with Nancy Graham there being out of the way, from what I'm hearing, the unify with Israel and let them rule over us bill 2-19 now seems to be in a lot of trouble. It was a sure foot in, but it seems to be having problems.
What's happened is the Democratic Party very slowly has woken up to the fact that the Israel lobby and the Israel cause is hated and despised by their voter base, particularly their younger voter base. But increasingly, even the boomer Jewish voters who were the last hold-ons really don't like Bibi Netanyahu.
Yeah.
And so the net effect of it is they have almost nobody in their corner. And a lot of the Israel lobby made the politically risky mistake of starting to go all in on backing the Republican and Trump brand. Mm-hmm. So that has encouraged even more Democrats to be like, why should we risk ourselves for somebody that's mostly funding Republicans anyway and funding Trump anyway and backing and running cover for Trump at CBS under Larry Ellison and Barry Weiss anyway? So for the first time ever, a majority of Democrats in the House voted to completely defund Israel. 2 years ago, that would have been 3 votes and they would have been censored for doing it.
Right.
So that is a massive, massive shift. And they can see how unpopular the Iran war is. They saw in Maine with Graham Plattner, even though they pushed him out, they saw how, it was an 80-20 Democratic vote to divorce from Israel out of the Maine Democratic primary for the Senate. So they're all looking around saying, this is, and then they saw Dan Goldman, longstanding deep state tied Democrat, go down 2-1 in New York City to a Mamdani-backed anti-Israel candidate. And they're starting to get the message. Another Democratic candidate who'd been in the House for 30 years lost her House seat to a hardcore leftist, really over just the issue of Israel in Colorado. And so they're like, okay, this isn't just a New York phenomenon. This is a nationwide Democratic phenomenon. They see Ro Khanna surging in the markets, in the predictive markets, because he's so critical of Israel and has become a harsh Israel critic. So the Democratic, I've said for a year now, whoever is the most anti-Israel candidate, a Democratic presidential primary in 2028 will win that primary on that issue alone. And as the Democratic Party wakes up to it and the Israel lobby loses its bipartisan dual support, dual party support, then they're going to be in serious trouble with bills like a bill that that nobody likes anyway. And they all they have left now are Republicans, and there are enough Republicans peeling off that they're unlikely to get these bills through the House and the Senate. And the same with the Russian sanctions bill. They'll either neuter it by making it optional so Trump can impose none of the sanctions if he wants, or it will just get killed in the Senate or never even get over to the House or passed in the House. Because without Graham there to whisper it through, and the increasing obvious controversy surrounding the Israel lobby, surrounding these wars in general, they're going to be in serious trouble politically.
It's amazing. One little man, I guess you could call him man. He was male. One little male entity was pushing that much evil and that much influence in this Washington giant machine. And you get rid of that one cog, and it turns out that's the master cog. That's amazing.
If you're looking at it from a cui bono perspective, if you're anybody who's anti-war or on the receiving end of these wars had a motivation to see Lindsey Graham go bye-bye. If you're looking at it from a murder suspect list, that's a long, long, long list.
Including most of the nations of the world.
And what is he sort of combined the three factors. One, he knew how to talk the talk of the old Southern conservative pro-American military side. Coming from a middle-class background in upcountry South Carolina. The second, he had incredible personable skills. If you were around Graham, he'd make people laugh. He was the charmer. He was the star of the party. He knew how to make everybody feel good on the golf course, drinking the cocktails. He wasn't like one of those nasty, anemic people at a cocktail party. He was the guy that made everybody else feel good at the cocktail party. And in a town driven by cocktail parties and run by cocktail parties, he was the maestro of that aspect of being able to play people like a fiddle. And then third, he was, like a lot of the people who were tied into the assassination plots against Kennedy, tied into the underground sexual deviant world. That these so many of them there. I think it was Steve Bannon's assistant, Natalie, I forget her last name, maybe Winters. And she was like, half the men, including the conservative men in this town in D.C., are secretly gay. And it's just it's like the recruiting for Catholic priests in the 1980s. Most of them bat the other way. There's a reason why they're trying to become priests, and it's not because they're attracted to women. It's the same thing, unfortunately, with a lot of the D.C. political class. People forget Dennis Hastert, longtime Republican Speaker of the House, was abusing young boys. They used to use the pages for that routinely. The congressional interns and young male associates and assistants were there for all the to the clot. But what's key is it's not just that they're gay; it's that they're closeted gay, and that makes all of them blackmailable, extortable, and bribable. And so Graham was a peak of that world too. So he was a perfectly situated to do the deep state's bidding in the halls of Congress. And without him, they don't have anybody easily there to replace him.
How is it that he was never on Epstein's list? Or was he on Epstein's list? He just never mentioned.
Because he's the kind of guy to stay out of a guy that knows how to blackmail people stays out of other people's blackmail books.
As opposed to Trump.
It was a sign of what his skill set was, and it was further proof of who he was.
As always told, the devil's not going to come in some red suit trident and horns coming out in every direction and a tail. He's going to come in a well-styled, cut suit, smooth-tongued, with a nice cigar, make you feel good. That's how evil infiltrates right there. Do we hang up? Rob. Internet. Come on, Internet. And we're back.
Voila.
I was hoping it wasn't going to last long enough for it to kick off and have to restart a new session. But yeah, like I was saying, though, the devil's not going to come in all horned up and pitchforked and everything else. It's going to come in a well-tailored suit with a cigar and a cocktail, and he's going to make you feel good, and he's going to tell you lots of things. I mean, this guy at the, I mean, was he a high priest in Satan?
Yeah, exactly. That's what you would think. A true demonic emissary of the deep state operations in the US. And he was the other thing with him, though, is there aren't more quite like him coming up. And so that's why they don't have an easy substitute between he and and he was always more effective than McCain at pushing the war agenda. But with their two passing, you have these sort of Russophobic, lower tiered advocates. It's still in the Senate, but none with the political juice and savvy of Graham. I mean, Graham actually convinced Trump that he was a Democratic whisperer and that he could get Democrats to go, which never made any sense because he never had any success at that at all. It was just their personal friendship and they would go along with his Russophobic agenda and his warmongering agenda, but not anything that was on Trump's domestic agenda. And yet
Right.
Trump would convince himself of these things. I mean, you could tell Trump was more broken up the death of Lindsey Graham
Oh
than he
yeah.
was the assassination of Charlie Kirk.
Oh
And
yeah. I've heard that.
tells you everything about where Trump is right now.
I've heard that. That Trump that basically almost had no emotions when Kirk got assassinated. And Kirk was one of the
Whereas
guys that
now,
got Trump elected.
he was breaking down crying. Like there was one interpretation that he was under shock when Kirk was assassinated, so I could get that. But there was none of the like true broken up days later that you could tell his voice was halting when talking about Lindsey Graham. And it's like, what in the world? It just shows you how far he had lost. But Graham
Oh
was
yeah.
whispering in, "You're the emperor. You're gonna be like Genghis Khan and Attila the Hun." And you can imagine Graham because he knew how to whisper those kind of things. He knew how to play right to the craziest parts of Trump's ego and his mind. And that's where Trump had completely lost it over 6 months of being worm tongue. And I'm hoping without worm tongue around, maybe we start to get a little bit more rational Trump back somewhere over the next 6 months before we go off an economic cliff with the Iranian war or get into a nuclear exchange with Russia.
Yeah, I'd rather avoid that last one. Conventional war is bad enough, but yeah, that nuclear option is just that's a game changer. Look,
Completely.
you've got great connections with Vance and people like that. They've got to be putting candles up right now, thanking God.
Oh,
Okay,
no doubt. I mean,
I don't need the I don't need the stress bills today.
Graham's exit affords a window of opportunity, probably definitely decreases the risk of any kind of Russian sanctions like Graham was trying to push getting actually instituted or installed. So at least takes off the escalatory ramp on that side of the equation and gives more options on the exit ramp on the Iranian conflict, though I think Vance's camp increasingly recognizes what Joe Kent and some others have been arguing, which is with Trump, since he only
Internet. And bugs are insane. Yeah, okay. I lost you at they what they realize? I think that was the last thing you said.
I think they increasingly realize Trump's mindset. He basically convinces himself the good thing will happen that he wants to have happen, and the bad thing can't happen. And he stays in that mindset for long periods of time, and getting him into a place of mental sobriety away from these repeated relapses into delusional Donald is increasingly difficult.
Delusional Donald. I like that delusional Donald.
And so if you're going to keep him out of that stage, what you've got to do is all he can see is capitulation or conquering. And he only will accept a compromise if he can recast it as them capitulating or him conquering. Iran is never going to allow him to have any deal that looks like, to the world, capitulation or conquering of the Persians. That means that the best option, which is Kent was ahead of the curve on this, recognizing this was the only option given where Trump's mindset was, which is he's either going to exit or escalate. He's not going to reach a meaningful, enforceable deal. So the Vance did everything possible to get the first ceasefire, did everything possible to get the MOU through. Trump's his rug pulled it so many times when he was almost on the verge of getting it, and even rug pulls it after he gets it, that at this point he realizes we've just got to come up with some sort of cover story to convince Trump to exit, because otherwise it's escalation, and escalation is a disaster. Vance knows it. General Kane knows it. The Pentagon knows it. The Secretary, Energy Secretary Wright knows it. Even Treasury Secretary Bessent recognizes it. They're just all cowards, and they're unwilling to push back at all against Trump, and are willing. Bessent's the worst. Bessent and Rubio and Hegseth are the worst at going along with Trump. Wright is having to go out in a self-humiliation campaign, disgracing his longstanding, well-respected legacy in the oil markets and energy markets by saying the dumbest stuff known to man. And like, you know, I was on with Daniel Davis earlier, and you could tell basically he kept using the word hostage over and over again. What he means is that he's a hostage. I'm a hostage. Somebody get me out of here. Somebody drag me out of here. For love of God, please.
So is he tapping SOS while he's giving the other?
Yeah, that's really what he's doing. It's like the eyes blinking. Like, he's like, well, please, you know, I feel bad for the guy because I know behind the scenes he lobbied against this war. And now he's got to get out there and say, no, the Strait of Hormuz is totally open. Well, we're getting like 70%, 80%. It's only the Iranian oil not going through. And he's trying to say this with a straight face, knowing it's a bald-faced lie, knowing that there's going to be people that make fun of him forever because of these statements, that he's Baghdad Bob of energy in the U.S. And he doesn't say it. He doesn't believe it. He said just the opposite to the president himself. So much so that's why he got left behind back on the beginning of this conflict. Remember, he got left behind. Vance got left behind because Trump was mad at them for telling him this won't go well. But the rest aren't willing to. They're a cabinet of cowards for the most part, other than Vance. And so Vance takes all kinds of heat and criticism. I mean, he says anything boo about the Israel lobby on the Joe Rogan show, and they go ballistic on him for, you know, a week online. The Barry Weiss and the CBSs and the Free Presses and all those people. But that's where we're at, is that they got to figure out a way to sell Trump on exiting, because everybody underneath knows escalation is a disaster for the economy, for the midterms, for what that Congress might look like after the midterms that will just investigate, impeach, and maybe even remove the president. First ever a president could be removed from office is Trump in 2027. That they understand the geopolitical risk, that they may lose alliances throughout the entire Gulf world. There might be essentially is NATO that unites Turkey, Pakistan, Iran, and the Saudis and the Gulf states. That they've even lost the Emiratis to a substantial degree. They've already lost the Qataris. They're losing the Saudis. The
Jordanians,
and
too.
So they completely. The Turks are at risk. And while they're getting dragged into further conflict in Russia by encouraging, incentivizing, and that Ratcliffe's running around yipping about how great it is that he's given them intel to go after Russia. And that stupid analysis they use of, oh, it was 19% occupied. Now it's 20% occupied.
Meanwhile, 2.4 million dead Ukrainian soldiers.
Correct. And they're not talking. That'd be like saying in the American Civil War, they only took Gettysburg. So what?
Yeah, you know, that's not major.
Do you not understand where how this progresses, how this proceeds? He's been. And then he gets Trump to from his legitimate concerns about the election integrity in the United States by yipping about China, and that China was not the problem with the 2020 election. And he gives you an idea of his empire mindset, that he wants to take down not only wants to be like Viceroy of Caracas and Havana, but he wants to say he conquered the three great civilizations, continuous civilizations in the world. See the Russians go down, see the Persians go down, and see the Chinese go down. And at different levels, he's in conflict with all three. And when he's making comparisons to him, to Attila the Hun and Genghis Khan, you get an idea of how his mind has gone totally AWOL. You got a King Lear with delusions of grandeur, and that's a whole different kind of problem. and everybody around him is in cowardice mode. The institutional elites are in delusional, constant, continuous states of delusion for the last three decades. And you've got the people that, like the Elbridge Colbys, Undersecretary of Defense and Vice President Vance, who recognize the risk, who aren't being heard and are treated like whiners and complainers and saboteurs when they're the only people trying to salvage and save the administration from itself and from global debacle.
I do not envy them. I mean, I'll tell you that much. No, I do not envy them. That is, that's, yeah. Like I said, last time we talked, you know, Vance is going to have to get serious treatment for PTSD after this.
Yeah, exactly. And in the middle of this, his fourth baby was born. You know, his youngest son was born.
Oh, so, congratulations to him.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, he's got a, and that was a surprise pregnancy. That was not a planned pregnancy. So, you know, he's trying to protect his young kids in the middle of this incredible global disastrous president that he can't tell anybody, at least not publicly, has completely lost it and is at the risk of blowing up the world at any given moment. And it's not the old Trump. People keep pretending it's the old Trump. And so the, you know, the Democratic critics always saw him as an ego-driven guy. So they don't recognize the change of behavior. They always saw the sheep as a wolf. And so when he shows up as a wolf, they don't recognize the danger that poses.
Right.
And then you've got the Trump partisans that are pretending it's still old Trump, that there's some game plan and strategy beneath and behind it all, that there's some broader, you know, he's taking on the city of London, or, you know, so they have to come up with more exotic and esoteric interpretations for this contradictory behavior that everybody can see. He contradicts what he himself said 2 weeks ago. 2 weeks ago, he said, we've got to get out. It'll be economic collapse. We've got to get out, or I'll be Herbert Hoover. We've got to, it's their money. And us continuing to do sanctions is just stupid. It undermines our economic power around the world. And now he's reversed himself on all of it and overnight without explanation.
I've seen clips and I've watched speeches where Trump counteracts himself in the same speech. You know, yes. It's like 5 minutes later, he'll just do it the opposite.
From Truth Post to Truth Post or within a Truth Post. It's striking to see. I mean, it's for a current American problem. I don't know to what degree Soviet Union leaders or Russian leaders might have had issue toward the end of their tenure, because you never know for sure what was mental decline, what was internal sabotage, when they would get sent to a dacha, like the kind that looks like your place. It usually meant, you know, you need to stay there for a little while. We need to have our own dacha policy. We need to have our own dacha. We can send our presidents when they lose their mind. To the dacha, to stay there for a little while. Don't worry.
Feed the ducks.
Like fake news, fake information. We'll feed you every day about how great you are. Let you be on fake interviews that nobody's actually watching, so that we can actually save the country from the such losers who are such leaders who are losing it.
Well, look, you know, there's rumor that Hillary Clinton may run as a Democrat again. I mean,
that
the U.S.
I mean,
it was bad enough last elections, you know, 320 million people. And the best you can come up with is Biden, Harris, and Trump. I mean, seriously. Yeah. Those three.
I mean, like, the only young candidate there never had an IQ to begin with. And they don't have an IQ to lose. And so you've got these more. And I think it will show up in third party and independent challenges and all of the rest. But I mean, a big problem is the delusional interpretation of global public opinion and domestic public opinion. I did like a little Substack piece because Mario Knopfler asked me to write one, because I was talking about he had never heard that the Iranian public did not, in fact, want to overthrow their government. I was like, I know we've done internal surveys. They've never published the CIA, but they're externally published surveys by Gallup, by the Pew Research Foundation, by the University of Maryland, by the Washington Institute for the Near East, which go into great detail about how the Iranian public opinion, they see a Shia leadership around the Shia world outside of Iran, not just in Iran, as right, protecting the Shia from global hostility, whether it's anti-Islamic hostility or Sunni-inspired right, hostility. And that's why the Shia in Pakistan have a favorable opinion of the Iranian Republic. the Shia in Bahrain have a favorable opinion, the Shia in Iraq, the Shia in Syria, the Shia in Lebanon, the Shia around the world, the Shia in the U.S., the Shia in the U.K. And it's just that most of the Shia in the U.K. and the U.S. and the West are not, or most of the Iranians are not religiously observant Shia in the U.K. and the U.S. They are in Iran. And they have a very favorable view of the government, of the republic. They have a higher view of how democratic their government is than Americans do, than UK does, than the French do, than the Germans do. So the idea that they see their and what is about 20 years ago, we set up this fake group. I say fake because it's a real group, but they do fake polls called Gammon, organized in the Netherlands. You know, you being in Russia, I've seen 100 versions of this. You know, you create a fake group, a fake group, funded by the NPD and say they do bogus polls and surveys that show all the Russian people want to overthrow Putin and all the rest. Everybody knows they're fake polls. Everybody knows they're fake surveys. But the West doesn't. They propagandize it as the only reliable source. You dig into the data, the Iranian people, no more than 20% of the country has ever wanted to change its form of government. And right now that's in the low single digits. What's interesting is you dig in, the University of Maryland did a poll in the fall after the summer of 2025 attacks. And you can see why there's public restraint on negotiation by the Iranian leadership, because public opinion already then had shifted, even before they did their we did the surprise attacks, taking out the Ayatollah, killing his four-year-old granddaughter, killing his daughter, killing his wife, killing 170 schoolgirls on the same day at the beginning of the attack. Even before that, the Iranian public wanted Iran to develop nuclear weapons. Yep. Wanted Iran to increase its ballistic missile capability. Did not want Iran to negotiate with the U.S. even then. So that's why they went against their own public by agreeing to the memorandum of understanding. Vance understood that. And to Vance's credit, he thought for a week he had Trump on board because Trump was talking the talk. And then the terrifying thing is what some of us have been telling the Vance's team is Trump is mentally not there anymore in a way that's ever trustworthy. And they convinced themselves, nah, if we work with him, he'll be back to being okay. And this proved me and our side right, that the guy is gone mentally. He cannot make competent and capable decisions. And we just got to – maybe there's a Russian Dasha we can send him. You know, say pretend he's talking to Putin every day and solving the world's problems and co-leading the world or something.
We got all Siberia. You know how many Dashas are out there? We can find one isolated, you know, nice, and we just bump in the information. You can set up a separate Fox News outlet out there that just bumps in PS information.
Exactly. Well, you know, the other person he compared himself to it was in that interview with on the regime change that book that got released was Stalin. He's like, I can be like Stalin. So maybe we can pretend, convince him he is Stalin. He's back in 1940. He's leading the counterattack. He's going to take out the Germans. Have some Russian singers there, like live choir singers singing to him, so he can pretend and imagine. We just got to get him out of the White House and away from the nuclear button and the war buttons, because he's as untrustworthy right now and unreliable as any leader in the world is and any leader in the world has been in quite some time.
You know, you go from somebody that's half brain dead and a zombie to somebody that's half brain dead and hyperactive.
Correct. Exactly. It turns out the zombie would be better. And I never thought I would say that.
I know. I'm shocked to say that myself.
I know. That's how on this set of policies Trump has become, that Biden would have been a less risky president than Trump has become, which is mind-boggling to me. But it also shows we just need reform. We need not to have leaders past the age of 75. It's just too risky. Once you get too old, not in that position of power, we've got to pull back. It's like having all these geriatric senators. You know, Feinstein was clearly dead. Somebody was voting for her. I mean, she died like six hours after her last vote. Everybody kind of knows Mitch McConnell is dead. And they're pretending he keeps putting out photos in the exact same shirt. It's like he never changes shirt or facial posture. Every single day is the exact same shirt. But somehow doesn't have but he can't do an interview then? Why can't he talk to a real person? Well, you know, not the Scott Jennings fake things. It's become a meme now. You know, Thomas Massey's like, I just talked to Mitch. And Mitch was like, man, we never should have opposed your campaign. We've got to get out of all these stupid wars. We got to control the Fed. You know, he's having fun with it. But everybody knows it. I mean, we got a senator who's probably dead. and we're pretending that it's not, that's all normal.
What was that? The weekend at the movie weekend at
weekend at Bernie's.
Bernie's. That's it. Bernie's.
This well, you know what we need. I'm just waiting for
month
the U.S.
And Bernie's.
You know? Vance has got to have a secret signal to everybody. You know, just have PBS broadcast Swan Lake, so we all know that's time for a little bit of a change.
Oh, I mean, it is ridiculous. It is just absolutely, you know, the Soviet Union went through something like this at the very end because they were, you know, premiers are moving out like that. They're just dropping dead because you had a pool of old guys, right? I mean, just really old guys. Gorbachev was the young guy that came in. But you had this pool of old guys that are going, it's my turn. And he gets in there and he drops dead, you know, 2 months. The next one drops dead in another half a year and on because these are all guard from, you know, from the original revolution or the next generation of them. And they're all in their 80s and 90s. Yep. I want to be there too. Yeah, there you go. You know, the thing is, I mean, sometimes you get people that are in their 80s, but they're quite competent. And hopefully we're all going to be living to, you know, 100 plus. But it's just something, yeah, I think, I won't go as far as to say you should just ban them outright. But I think there has to be a competency test every single year, or maybe twice a year. And from neutral parties.
Correct. I mean, the argument I've made here in the States is that, you know, our Constitution had a minimum age that for its time and place was very aggressive, that basically were requiring you to reach your elder stage of life in terms of leadership for that period of time. But the younger stages of that before you could run for the Senate, before you could run for the White House. As like the same logic is that we need to put a cap because now that we've been able to extend life way past the normal, the idea at the time of the founding, we're able to extend life, but not always able to extend intellectual and emotional decision-making capacity.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And we need to put the same, at least, you know, some sort of limit on that side of the aisle. Now, at least in the war context, the founders thought in America that they had solved the problem because they took away the power of war from the president. They're like, he can only execute war. He can't declare war. And Congress will be the check to prevent somebody losing their mind or losing their soul in that position of power because they can't start a war. And unfortunately, we haven't meaningfully enforced that in the better part of a century. And that failure to enforce has enhanced this problem of people being too old. And Biden had it, Reagan had it, Woodrow Wilson had it. These people that suffer some sort of severe emotional or health breakdown at the end, Nixon was breaking down. I mean, he was talking to the paintings like they were real. So
it's
too risky to.
Maybe they were.
Exactly. Who knows? Yeah. I mean, I'm just waiting for Trump to do that. I mean, imagine if Trump was an alcoholic. Thank God Trump doesn't drink at all because that probably reduces some of the risk. But imagine if he was drinking on all this stuff. But the other problem is the internal, like the doctor is intimidated by Trump. So the doctor's not going to give him an honest exam, even if it flashes red signals on that exam. And then the problem is emotional behavioral dementia of the executive, where you lose your executive function in your brain, only doesn't show up on a lot of tests. Usually you don't even know the person fully had it. People who've known them a long time can see it, but generally it's not something you can fully know until they're dead and you can look into the brain and see what the damage was. We don't have great testing for it. So it makes the problem worse. And then you have institutional media covering up for it. So it's Trump is full thorough proof that there's a weakness and vulnerability in our system that we need to find an institutional remedy to because it will otherwise keep repeating and reoccurring.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, I'm telling you, it's just a reminder of the Soviet Union at its last stages. It's the same damn thing.
Well, it's the sign of a decaying empire.
Yep.
It's peak hubris. I mean, Christopher Nolan remakes The Odyssey, and he takes out the whole premise of hubris and makes it all about male toxicity.
No way. Shapiro, which, you know, he's a joke about a human being for the most part. But, when he comes out with, well, the Greeks aren't exactly white. My Greek friends are like Mental explosion. Thank
Exactly.
God.
Well, I mean, it tells you something that he makes a Greek movie in Greece about a Greek tragedy that has no Greek actors in it. Yeah, I
I
mean,
know.
that gives you a mindset of where Nolan is. But the biggest thing was like, I don't mind all the retconning and the DEI and all the other jazz, as long as he kept the story of hubris in,
Oh, yeah.
because it's a particularly apt story for Europe. It's a particularly apt story for the US, given what we're experiencing in the way in which we're going out on with conflict with Iran, China, and Russia. We're doing it in this hubris kind of manner rather than a geopolitical realist manner. The part that I think about Nixon that was good, which was getting detente, Soviet Union opening the doors to China, ultimately willing to get out of Vietnam belatedly, but at least getting out, knowing it was going to fall. And we entered 15 years of no major wars, the longest time period after World War II since before World War I. And so there was a lot of, you know, the argument for that side of geopolitical realist Nixon. But the story of hubris and nemesis is always is the great Greek stories that warn about getting over your skis, about not understanding your adversary, about thinking you can do things that you can't, that are beyond your limits, about provoking the fate of the gods by being so arrogant to think you are one, which is the way Trump is behaving at times. And the that story is a great universal story. Unfortunately, Christopher Nolan eviscerates that part of the story, making it men bad, women
I
good.
disagree with you. Nolan incorporated that story into the whole process of the movie, the hubris. Nolan is embodied the hubris. So the story,
He
when
is the
the
hubris.
movie fails, and it will, obviously, Nolan is the hubris. He's taking it to the next level, man.
It's Hollywood hubris at just a, that he could retcon a story as famous and legendary and as great as the Odyssey, arguably, you know, the most important story in Western civilization, the kind of anchor and foundation to Western civilization, and a particularly apt warning of to the modern world is
Oh
just it's Hollywood on steroids.
yeah. The actress, I don't remember her name, the one that plays Helen. She, apparently she had never even heard of the Odyssey. Never mind, I never read it. She never even heard of it until she was cast.
Well, that was a reflection. I think she went to Yale, where I went to undergrad for part of the time. And what was happening is Yale was shifting away from the Western greats, the old canon, so that what you would read is some alternative interpretation of something rather than the original text material itself. That's what, like, a lot of Americans will probably like the movie because it has cool effects in it and, you know, historic stories and a little bit of romance and a little bit of action and a few monsters, because they don't know it's a degradation of the original story that was, and they don't realize that the original story was so essential to civilization because it used to be something a generation or two ago in America, everybody read. Now the new generations don't.
On that note, we can I want to thank you for coming on. It's always a great conversation. And like I said, I think we're gonna see the hubris at a new level on the Odyssey. It's Newland has embodied the hubris. We should celebrate with him. He's taking it to a new level.
And he'll get the awards and designation and recognition for it, just like Trump thinks he will at the end of this conflict. But he's probably like more likely to get an, he won't get Odysseus ending. He'll get an ending that was somewhere about was for Odysseus' ship crew if he continues on his current path.
Eaten, swallowed, or turned into animals. They
Exactly.
had a pretty shitty life.
They sure did.
They were the red shirts of Star Trek. They beamed down, they're all red shirted. Yep, they're all gonna die. That's it.
Yep,
They're done.
exactly.
They're done.
Yep, that's how it's turned out. And Trump risked that fate if he continues to tempt fate.
We'll see. We'll see. I'm looking forward to having another talk with you because it's always fun. And Washington provides plenty of material.
No doubt about it. Glad to see you, man.
Thank you. Thank you, everybody, for joining. Cheers.